as this conference has clearly demonstrated, in any nation state, arts have been a meaningful means to promote nationalism. As Gayatri Spivak insightfully noted, arts help people to join the authorities in the task of massive rememoration project, saying, "We all suffered this way, you remember. This is what happened, you remember." So that history is turned into so-called cultural memory. Nation states and propaganda machines have enjoyed utilizing music's ineffability, as any desired meaning can be attached to it through making it part of everyday ritual. Through public broadcasts and performances, nation states strive to create a specific nation-oriented everyday sound aura that Brian Currie calls a national acoustics. When all sound representations are controlled by the government, only those music types that people become accustomed to through the institutionalized sound transmissions are considered to be permissible. And many composers consciously or subconsciously choose to follow the often unwritten but clearly perceptible rules of the national acoustics to accommodate ideology, funders, and employers. And it happened especially often under the totalitarian regimes discussed at our conference. I'm slightly surprised that I'm the only one here talking about Russian music, and everybody else talks about my former country in certain terms. I'm no longer a resident there either, so I will allow myself a few, terms along the same lines. I have to say that in Russia, professional music made it to the Russian national platform by employing the same two obvious super icons that help prove the fact of national affiliation in everyday life, as in all other countries that we are discussing here. These are folk tunes and religious chants. And I'll briefly touch upon both of these elements in my presentation before I get to the main topic of my talk, the composer Yuri Butsko. Folk tunes and religious chants have influenced the national acoustics in different periods of Russia's history. It's important to note that the ancient artifacts normally don't obtain greater legitimacy or better distribution when converted into sources for professional music. This process has always served the opposite purpose. Utilizing these artifacts, or their simulacra, in the professional arena helps the composers validate their music as a legitimate part of the Russian national representation. However, to cultivate and dignify the Russian melodic material, professional Russian composers relied on Western compositional techniques, placing Russia squarely on the globalized map rather than ghettoizing and over-elevating its artistic and political uniqueness. Many contemporary composers still frame their geographically Russian art by inserting Western-style embellishments and exotic versions of Western compositional techniques adorned with Russian trimmings still get exported abroad with great success. For instance, one of the works by a living Russian composer that is frequently performed both in Russia and in the West is the 8-minute-long Concerto for Orchestra No. 1 by Rodion Shchedrin, Azarnye Chestushki, Naughty Limericks. While utilizing the low genre of her humorous and often indecent songs with primitive melodies, Shchedrin also nods to Copland in the overall people-friendly idea of the piece. And the real source of his inspiration, however, was Stravinsky's visit to Russia in 1962, the year before the piece was written. Thus, the made-up Russianness of Stravinsky's method that synthesized, in Richard Taruskin's words, this country's musical traditions, both those reflective of high literate culture and those of folklore, made it full circle in contemporary Russian music. Shchedrin imaginatively employed a Petrushka-enriched combo Russian outlook that modernizes the rhythmic diversity and the colors of quasi-folk elements, but combining them with the Western instrumental tradition, thus attempting to refresh the potency of the Russian music brand in both Russia and the West. Let's listen to several seconds of this piece. ¶¶ we just heard wasn't a folk tune. It was a well-crafted simulacra, and it was nicely adapted to the medium of the symphony orchestra by using the funny timbres and sharp accentuations within an even and square beat. As we just heard in this example, most of the time when adapted into high art, both real folk tunes and their imitations have been edited to accommodate patriotic dispositions in the Russian and then the Soviet Empire. Such versions were appropriated by the government supporters as identity constructs intended to nourish ideological tasks. In other words, they became the main source of the Russian national acoustics. After they are institutionalized in this manner, they bounce back into the repertoire of the ensembles that pride themselves for advocating Russian folk music. As opposed to these postcard variants, unedited, autochthonous Russian music has rarely made it to the professional concert stages. In fact, such elevation was never destined to succeed anywhere. The aboriginal performance art of any country rarely survives transplantations into a concert hall, especially when shifted into the medium of orchestral instruments and professional structures. Nevertheless, since the early 1970s, a few more, especially Russian, or to be more precise, consciously less Western features have been used in some works by contemporary Russian composers. Paradoxically, utilizing a more inherently Russian approach doesn't necessarily translate into a more nationalistic approach. Very often, introducing elements of heritage revival went against the official promulgations of nationalism. New explorations of Russian folk principles in contemporary music were inspired by the efforts of Dmitry Pokrovsky, a front-rank ethnomusicologist who strived to revive folklore's true regional nature. Doing so meant to place oneself in opposition to the official nationalism and narodnost that featured, among other examples, songs and dances performed in a quasi-folk manner by Lyudmila Zykina and the Berezka Dance Ensemble. The folk ensemble established by Dmitry Pokrovsky has commissioned many important Russian composers to write some very interesting pieces for this group, and there are some names over here. A few of their pieces were written during the period we're discussing today, though. Most of them were created later, after 1989. As for the other super icon, the religious chant, the story of its revival is much more complicated. During the Soviet era, the great Russian sacred tradition, music tradition, had fallen into obscurity and neglect, as you know. It was considered ideologically suspect to perform or compose any kind of sacred music in the USSR. Despite the efforts to eradicate it entirely, orthodoxy remained functional, even thriving in the hearts of the faithful. And in fact, some scholarly research was officially permissible, such as paleography or restoring the old religious artifacts, or studies of different schools of iconography and similar scholarly interests in music. However, religious practice in churches was not allowed. Towards the end of the Soviet era, when the prohibitions on religion began to gradually soften at the state level, orthodoxy, if not faith per se, then at least some knowledge about it, became one of the driving forces that motivated stylistic developments in the art of many composers. You can see some names here. It's a pretty substantial list. All of these composers, in one way or another, embodied religious aspects in their art beginning in the mid-1960s. Despite their very different creative methods, all of them came to adhere to the same spiritual tendency. They saw the contemporary world through the prism of philosophical contemplation and religious belief. How some composers who identified with orthodoxy conveyed their spirituality through their art in spite of official prohibitions illuminates yet another way of expressing Russian identity through heritage revival. Today, I will only concern myself with the music written before orthodoxy became officially allowed in Russia, which happened along with the celebration of the 1000th anniversary of Christianity in Russia in 1988. Right at the end of the period we are discussing here. Around that time, orthodoxy became fashionable and then brought controversially nationalistic tendencies in the following decades, with some composers exploiting church-related features in an attempt to redefine both their art and the meaning of Russianness altogether. Many have played the religious card in order to engage new followers while detonating artistic, aesthetic, and branding incentives into a suspiciously unhealthy religion-infused musical mix that was instigated by the current nationalistic repositioning. Lately, as David Remnick put it in his pre-Sochi article in the New Yorker, Putin has promoted and elevated the Orthodox Church as a symbol of Russianness. But back in the period we are discussing today, religion was still prohibited. As Marina Rakhmanova, a prominent researcher of early Russian music, said in a recent interview, nobody would snatch away a znamenny book from your hands, but nobody would encourage using it either. In the mid-60s, her husband, composer Yuri Butsko, found a successful way to adapt the old chant to modern times, while at the same time preserving its religious context and meaning. The unique compositional technique he developed helped to bridge liturgical experience and the concert stage by means of a rather calculated but inspired methodology derived from the structure of the Znamenny chant. As you know, Znamenny chant is the main form of Russian church chant. It's generally diatonic and it is sung as no instruments were allowed in Orthodox church services. Attempts were made starting in the 19th century to transfer the chant into the realm of instrumental music, beginning with Rimsky-Korsakov's Russian Easter Overture. But most of them failed to embrace the modal system of the Znamenny chant, as composers tended to harmonize each sound of the chant with a new chord, that is, vertically, rather than making sense of them by means of counterpoint, that is horizontally. Yuri Butsko's system offered a new way to bring the Znamenny chant to the professional music arena. Although the chant was originally limited by the compass of a human voice, Butsko extended its range in accordance with its scale structure, which consists of two trichords separated from each other by half tone. This is the main Znamenny chant scale. Butsko did it by adding trichords up and down. They are all similarly separated by half tones. And then they reach the initial pitch and complete the circle. The system has 12 tones. Therefore, Butsko describes it as Russian dodecaphony, a 12-tone row extracted from ancient Russian materials. There is an axis in this system between E and F above middle C, and in relation to it, any consonants can have a mirror reflection in the opposite segment of the row. The entire sound space is logically coordinated around this single axis in such a way that direct and inverted motions and symmetrically organized chords become the major texture-forming building blocks. Butsko often juxtaposes different versions of the original chant or of his own melodies in the character of the Znamenny chant in polyphonic and heterophonic layers. This makes the texture of his music viscous and resilient, its fabric and melodic pattern pleasantly heavy. All of this is unspooling in an atmosphere of continuously elaborated monotony and rotations within a single sound sphere of extended length. The composer interprets Znamenny chant as the ideal of spiritual perfection, the goal to be constantly pursued, and avoids decorating it with fancy mannerisms. The timeless and impersonal old Russian chant that acquires the semantics of a single and inevitable objective is a reference point for all times for Butsko. Butsko's system was fully established in the Polyphonic Concerto in 1969. This piece was written for four keyboard instruments, piano, organ, harpsichord, and celeste. Such instrumentation helped to create an interesting acoustic thickness close to that of a reverberant choral performance in a church setting, because it's impossible to tune these instruments without slight variances between themselves. This is a monumental 3.5 hour long cycle of 19 counterpoints in which the composer applied this technique to the original Znamenay chants that had been deciphered from 16th and 17th century manuscripts by Brajnikov, Uspensky, and Rachmanova. Counterpoint 19, the last one, is written for all of the main instruments, plus choir and several percussion instruments, and it provides a monumental finale. The main chant, Let Everything That Has Breath Praise the Lord, is laid out as a set of variations, in the last of which the choir, singing without words in unison, is joined by the organ, playing the theme at the octave, and by the vibraphone, treating the same theme in a canonic fashion, thus increasing the reverberations to the utmost extent. Other instruments enter with aleatoric sections reflecting upon the different emotions experienced by the parishioners during the church service: pride, resignation, determination, agitation, and exaltation. Let's listen to a fragment from the last movement. There has been a whole generation of contemporary Russian composers who have utilized Butzko's Russian dodecaphony, including Alexander Vustin, Mikhail Kollontai, and Nikolai Korndorf. All three began using Butzko's scale right after the period we are concerned with today. For instance, Vustin's White Music for Organ was written in 1990, and talking about this piece, he called Butzko's system an ingenious discovery that featured harmonic clarity and organized music within a fragile and transparent choral fabric. The most important of those who used Butzko's system was Alfred Schnittke, who admitted having heard about Russian church music from Butzko, with whom he attended a pre-conservatory college in Moscow. In 1984, Schnittke wrote his Symphony No. 4 for vocal soloists, chorus, and orchestra based on the traditional 15 mysteries of the Rosary, which recalls the life of Mary. The Rosary structure predicated the form of the symphony. Its single movement is organized as a set of 15 variations on four themes grouped into four segments. Schnittke wanted to unite together four main confessions: Judaism, Catholicism, Protestantism, and Russian Orthodoxy, by using themes rooted in the four confession-specific scales. The last Orthodox theme is built on Butzko's principle of Russian dodecaphony. Each of the four themes is unveiled in the form of canon, each with its own polyphonic structure, instrumentation, and dynamics. These canons gradually join each other in linear and textural juxtapositions until all four themes coalesce in a polyostinato ecumenical coda. Butzko's scale represents a unique example of indigenizing a transnational compositional technique, dodecaphony, by kneading principles of Russian chant scale construction into its core. It's hard to say what actually took place first, Russification of dodecaphony or dodecaphonization of Russian chant. But the result was quite astounding for its time. In the midst of the Cold War, a Russian composer reached out to the world by globalizing an unabashedly pre-Soviet musical element. At the time, this could be considered a nonconformist gesture against the regime of the state. Paradoxically, however, Butzko's system marked his desire to validate Znameny chant as a legitimate means of Russian national representation. Butzko's utilization of Znameny chant could have supported the state had the state patronized orthodoxy, but this wasn't the case at the time. Butzko's nationalism was not driven by the party and the government. It was not created under the banner of dissidents, and it was not dictated by the desire to be appreciated in the West as an object of state repression. Instead, he was trying to get to the essence of things, and he found it in a unique combination of a Western 12-tone idea with the archetypal Russian material, which itself was structurally and ideologically cleaner than the folk element. It's also important to remember that when Orthodoxy became the state religion after Perestroika, Butzko never joined the official Moscow Patriarchy and remained faithful to the old believers' practice. Butzko's non-official nationalism was a type of fronde in the original French meaning, as he was expressing a quiet unhappiness with the powers and their policies without actively fighting against them. As we can see from his example, Russianness can be demonstrated in many different ways, and not always would it coincide with nationalistic attitudes. Thank you.